Hey, welcome back to another episode of the Ready Your Future podcast, where you are equipped with the essential tools and knowledge to ensure you and your loved ones thrive through any crisis. Join me as we navigate the world of preparedness so you can safeguard your future and be your family's survival guide. Hey, I'm Todd Sepulveda, a regular guy living in the suburbs, trying to spread the word about getting prepared for the future. Hey everyone, I have a great one for you today. I'm really excited about this one. But before we jump into the episode, I want to just give a couple of shouts out. First to Robin for buying me a coffee over at buymeacoffee.com. Thanks so much, Robin. And then I want to just give a shout out and a big thank you to the new members of the Top Preparedness Articles. That is just a true blessing when I see those come through. So thank you guys. And thank you for all those that just renew your support every month with that. So thank you for that. All right, so today's episode, we're going to go international, and we're getting a fascinating perspective on prepping from our guest, Niklas Larsson from Sweden. So Niklas has a unique background that shapes his approach to readiness. So growing up in rural Sweden without indoor plumbing to serving in the military and being involved with Sweden's Civil Defense Association, Niklas' path into preparedness has given him some unique skills and experiences. So he's going to share those insights with us and how his preparedness has evolved over the years. It's a wide-ranging discussion covering a lot about preparedness that you can apply to your own readiness. So let's go ahead and jump into this interview with Niklas Larsson from Hembruskap, and I hope I said that right. Probably not. Sorry, Niklas, which means home preparedness in Swedish. Well, hey, everyone, I have Niklas Larsson, and I know that I have said that wrong. I talked about him a few episodes back. He helped me out with some recording software, and was very appreciative of it. And I learned that he has a podcast, and he does preparedness in Sweden as well. And so I'm very happy to have him on the podcast today and to talk a little bit about preparedness in general, but then preparedness in Sweden as well. So Niklas, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be here. It's a bit surreal to see you live. I've been listening to your voice the past 8 years, but always like in back log time.
Well, I appreciate it. Now, I know I didn't say your name correctly, so say it for everyone the Swedish way, I guess.
Yeah, the Swedish way is Niklas Larsson.
All right.
I travel a lot, and I like never use that anyway, so...
That works out. And I think we were saying beforehand, before we started recording, that there's Larsons here in the United States, definitely all over the world. And so that's easy to say. So we'll go with that one. But I completely understand, because my last name is hard for a lot of people to say, and I just go with it, right? That's where we're at. But to start out here, tell us a little bit, and we'll get into, you know, what preparedness in Sweden and your podcast and YouTube channel and all the things that you're doing, your website. But before we even jump into that, share with us a little bit about your preparedness journey.
Well, I think it goes like way back to my childhood. I grew up on the countryside under pretty frugal circumstances in the Swedish perspective. We didn't get indoor plumbing until I was 10. We only had two channels on the TV, which was like a major lack of entertainment. There were actually only 8 kids in my class, so I was pretty rural. I had to walk 2 miles to get to school and back in the afternoon, and the closest village with a grocery store was about 10 miles away. So, I mean, if you forgot to buy something, you had to do it on the next week. So you have to plan ahead. So I think that was like a common sense of how you do things when I was growing up with my mother and my father. We also had huge forest areas and several lakes. That was like the plus side. So I went exploring, fishing. And I remember, as my cousin had a VHS player, that he got some good like military movies, you know, Rambo, Commando, Predator, Navy SEALs. And I think those trips into the woods took a more surrealistic theme, building traps and building shelters, spending the night. So that was like the gateway into it. And then after high school, I applied to military service. During the 90s, when I did it, it was still mandatory. We had a period now when it wasn't. Now it is again. We will come back to that. So I did pretty well on the entrance exam and examined as a second lieutenant in the light infantry. But this was in the period of everlasting peace in Europe. We actually invited the Russians to join our military training operations. So I remember my first operations in the military, you always had a Russian advisor standing there like, oh, how many people are in this exercise? And I was like, about 10,000, because that was a pretty big exercise. Oh, how many dead people do you expect? And I said, like, none. Oh, in Russia, 10,000 soldiers, we expect 4 deaths. And well, okay. So they shut down a lot of regiments, and I was told that I should apply to a mechanized brigade and get further training, but I didn't see any future then in the army. And for the next 25 years, I was totally right, actually. They shut down a lot of operations. So I went to university, worked in telecom, went to become a high school teacher. My main subjects, actually religion and social science. And 2006, my daughter was born. And I think then my more survivalist military interest turned into prepping and home preparedness, because suddenly you weren't alone. You had like someone else to care for. And it's not practical to like go to the store all the time. And I remember also when we were out like visiting different places and playgrounds in the city, that plastic spoons had like a big part of the prepping experience, because you could buy like baby food and yogurt and stuff like anywhere, but they never sold any spoons. So you always had to have like a couple of spoons with you wherever you went. So eventually there were spoons like in the car, in my jackets, in my backpacks, like everywhere. So that was when I like started to think about prepping and home preparedness. Like, there must be some kind of system. Someone else must have thought these ideas. So I went online, like everyone do nowadays when you wonder something. And I actually found Zombie Squad. I checked them out earlier today, zombiehunters.org. They don't seem to be active anymore. But I know they had a huge part in the Katrina, collecting money, disaster relief and such. So they were like one part disaster relief and one part preparedness. And they had a chat forum. So we realized we were actually several Swedes here at the west coast of Sweden. So we started a local chapter. And that eventually transformed into a forum called Swedish Survivalist. We have to say, a big vibe of doomsday preppers to it. We were anonymous, nicknames. You weren't actually supposed to meet up, but some of us did anyway. But I didn't really like the whole OPSEC security thing. I mean, I wanted to contribute to make a better society. So first I joined a local safe walk group. It was a group that during Fridays and Saturdays offered primarily younger women to go from the local bus station to their door so nothing would happen, because there had been a murder a couple of years earlier in that area. So, but then I find out about the Civil Defense Association, which is a voluntary defense organization that are sanctioned by the state. And shortly after that, I also returned to the army to a recon squad in the Home Guard. So ever since 2008, I've been a part of both the civil defense and the military defense, because I realized that war is war, and that is like the ultimate crisis, but it will happen a lot up to that, snowstorms, floodings, and stuff like that. So I thought that I can do a lot in the civil defense up to the part where I have to join the army to go into service full time.
Wow, man, that's a lot and a lot of good stuff. And I didn't want to interrupt you but I was thinking about a lot of things as you were speaking. Let's go back to the time when you were a kid, right? And you were like you said, you lived a lot more rural. It's funny because when we talk in preparedness over here in America, a lot of the times people will say, My grandparents didn't have running water, or there, some people that were very, very rural will say, yeah, we didn't have we didn't have running water, or we didn't have a restroom inside. We had an outhouse, that kind of stuff. I know my dad tells me stories about visiting some of his family members out, more in a rural setting. And although they had all the conveniences of life in the city, out there they had outhouses, and he completely hated it and stuff like that. But I mean, you were living a lot of that type of lifestyle, even at your age, which you're probably about my age, it seems like. And so a lot of the times we talk about that stuff, it's older people that are really having that experience. So I want to ask you then, when you went from that type of a lifestyle to moving into like the military, you went off to the military, and then you saw, I guess, some of the other conveniences of life. Why, how did your perception of all that change? And then was there ever a thought to go back to that rural setting, maybe after the military?
Well, I think there's a specific mindset that I brought with me from my rural time. So, I mean, we had potatoes, onions, beets, some chickens, and a pig that survived almost to Christmas every year. And I remember when I went to high school, when we there's a Swedish dish called blood pudding, which is actually made of pig's blood that you fry and you eat it with lingonberries. And I used to tell my classmates, like, how do you do blood pudding? Yeah, you beat the pig's head in, and you slice its throat, and you cut it up, and you hang it, and all the blood pours out. And they're like, what? Isn't this like made like in a factory? Well, oh yeah, maybe, but the procedure is like pretty much the same. So I always think I had like a better connection with how things worked for real in the society. I know I hear horror stories about, I mean, kindergarten children here in Sweden who doesn't know where milk come from. So I haven't seen a cow. And that was a thing I also brought with me in the army. So I have never had any like psychological problems with death and blood and stuff like that. So that I think rural kids have an advantage from city kids, absolutely. Fun fact, I actually killed my first deer with my bare hands.
Oh, wait, you got to tell us the story on that one.
it was pretty much an accident, actually. I was riding my bike, and it was a very steep hill, and I was riding like very fast downhill, and basically a young deer attacked me from the ditch, just jumped up on me. So I, in self-defense, I think I hit my left knee right on the head. So I kind of bashed its head with my knee. So it was just going to my father's second cousin, dragging it, butchering it. And then my mom actually got the saddle to prepare for Sunday dinner. So it tasted extra good, I think. So, I mean, those are things that rarely happen in the city, I guess.
Oh, definitely, definitely. So when you left rural, and I guess you went to the military, were you any thought about going back there, or was it like, no, I kind of like the city now, or how did that go?
Now, I mean, we discussed this in my family a lot. My wife is also from the rural areas, and she still have a lot of relatives with farms. But I think it was a big deal breaker. Maybe like 10 years ago, we were sitting there Christmas dinner, and everybody was telling about all the work they were doing on the farms. They had to like put a new roof on. They would have to like the forest had to take been taken care of. They have to dig ditches, and it was like a really that was a lot of work. And most of them also had regular jobs, so that was like they went to a job and then they put like 3 4 hours every day to just take care of the property. And I think that I'm not a doom and gloom, as you say. I don't expect the end of the world as we know it, so I never seen like the priority of it. I have a farm to go to. I mean, in case shit hits the fan, we can always go to one of the relatives still. So maybe I've been lucky that way. I can be both worlds if I want to, I guess. So I have to work on the on some farm, and I know farm where I can work, but it's pretty practical to live in the city. And I think also that raising two kids, I remember when I was a kid that you really couldn't go anywhere. If I was to play with some kid from school, that have to be arranged. I have to be like get a someone to drive me. You have to set a specific time when I went home again. And I see that my children have like they've done what they want with their time. They can go anywhere. They can stay out late and then walk home if they like to. So yeah, the city has some appeal to it.
That's great. And you know, it's one of the things that people always talk about homesteading and preparedness and like, hey, you know, I want to go buy a farm. I want to homestead. I want to do all that kind of stuff. But unless you have a whole lot of money where you're able to kind of float financially for a long time while you get the homestead up and running, you are going to have to work at a real job, or someone's going to have to work at a real job. And then, yeah, it's a lot of work. I have heard from more people than I think most realize that they go and they try the homesteading and they go out and living on a farm, and then they wind up coming back, you know, because of it wasn't all that they thought it was going to be.
So yeah, really- we have a pretty big prepper community here in Sweden that started on Twitter, now X, and now everybody fled that platform. And there were actually a couple of examples where pretty well-known preppers went out to the countryside. 1-2 years later, they came back to the city, mostly because the family didn't handle it. And they also thought that it was easier to make money from a homestead to like be self-sufficient also economically. But it's really, really, really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of people find that out the hard way. But no, a lot of great stuff here. And I want to get into a little bit to your the civil defense situation a little bit later on. But the fact that you were, and I love what you were saying about you wanted to give back and you were helping, you know, even just the safe walk. You know, we have like guardian angels here. You know, they started in New York, I think, and then they were here in the Houston area for a time. But kind of the same kind of idea where people were out there patrolling for safety and things like that. What did others say about that when y'all were offering that and y'all were, you know, doing that to help keep young girls safe, you know, traveling to the bus stop and traveling home?
Well, I think my parents and also my wife's parents never had any questions about it because they were also in a lot of societies and helping out with football teams and stuff like that. But I remember my brothers always asking me, like, do you get paid for that? And I said, no, I don't. And then they're like, why? So that was always my middle brother always have like a common question when we meet, like, are you doing things you're getting paid for now, or are you still working for free? And the answer is mostly I'm still working for free mostly. But also when you get higher up in different organizations, you actually do get paid. So nowadays, most of my work, I get a fee for doing it. So, but I mean, service has always been a central part of my family's legacy. And we are a more hardcore variant of Lutherans. That has a saying that it's service above all. And we used to joke, like, if you don't work overtime, you're doing something wrong, because then you're not doing enough service for your employer or for your community. So my father always worked a lot during my childhood as well. So
I that's great, man. And when you say Lutheran, I went to a Lutheran school early on when I was going to school. And so I know a lot of Lutherans, have a lot of Lutheran friends, and I would agree with that. You know, I think though the older generation has, well, and I say older, I'm talking about, you know, people our age have this idea of working hard and putting in the effort. I don't know so much if the, you know, the younger generation has that. Is that something that you're seeing where you're at in Sweden, a difference?
Well, we usually talk about this, usually when I'm at the headquarters in our capital city. But we do a lot of research and science on the voluntary services in Sweden. And Sweden is kind of unique, I think, in a European perspective. 9 out of 10 Swedes are in an organization, an NGO. Some of them are of egoistic reasons, boat organizations and stuff like that. But actually, latest studies show that 54% of the Swedes still put down time that are unpaid in different organizations. And that has been pretty constant over the time. What we see, though, is that people don't want to be on boards as board members or accountants or stuff like that. They don't want to be that formal kind of organization. They just want to show up, do their thing, and then do something else. We have an organization called Missing People, which I think you also have. Mm-hmm. And studies show that 92% of the people who participate in their activities only do it once. Okay. So they do it, they take some pictures, they post it on Facebook, and then they find something else new. And we also see that young people organize themselves like in other areas of life. I have a friend from my childhood who always was a big organizational participant, but he nowadays spends most time online. He has joined a space fleet on a server on Iceland, and he's their insurance regulator when they go to war with other countries in space in this virtual server. He makes sure that people are financially paid back for their losses. And he's still doing a lot of free time, but maybe not that, I mean, not that matters, in my opinion, not in the real world.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's really interesting. Really interesting. And I think the service part of it, for me, is really interesting. I think we have a lot of people who want to serve and do that, especially during the holidays around here. But I think y'all have a higher percentage on a regular basis, even if it's a one-time deal. Now, you mentioned doing things for free. And I started laughing a little bit because a lot of the times the things that we do in the preparedness community and build, you know, the websites and the podcasts and stuff like that. I mean, we're not doing it to make a whole lot of money. So I figure you're probably doing the same thing. I've always said that with the website and the podcast, I want to break even. I don't want to dig into my own personal finance to be able to fund that. That's kind of been my goal. My goal has never been to make it a business where I would, you know, quit my job and anything like that. So you have a website and you have a podcast, and I think I said it, I looked it up, right? And I think I did Google Translate to give me the pronunciation. I said it on last week's podcast. We're recording this and it'll come out again in a couple of weeks, but I think it's Humberskap. Is that right? Or did I say it wrong? Correct. Yeah. Say it correctly. How about that?
Hemberedskap.
Hemberedskap.
But your translation was spot on. It is home preparedness.
Home preparedness. It was weird because Google Translate first said it was Kurdish, and I can't remember what the translation is now that it said. But then when I changed it to Swedish, it did home preparedness. So I thought that was pretty cool. So tell us a little bit about the background behind that, because you're involved in a lot of different things. You're doing a lot of service type stuff. You're, you know, all that stuff. Was it just natural to start the podcast and the website, or was this something more that you wanted to do?
Now, this was actually out of convenience from the start. The last 15 years, I've been doing lectures and courses on home preparedness, survivalist. I'm also a SEER instructor. So I've been doing a lot of courses, and it was always so many questions. Like, you can sit, like, if you had the time, sometimes for hours after a course, and people like kept putting answers and questions. And I once realized that it must be a better way to do this. So then I met a guy who has a lot of podcasts, who was my producer in the beginning. He said, like, you should start a podcast. Then you can just tell people, like, listen to this episode. Then you don't have to explain it, and they will get like a deeper meaning and a depth when you can like speak for 30 minutes instead of just answering a quick question. So we recorded 5 episodes that were based on one of my lectures, and then we recorded another 5 episodes that were based on another lecture. And then I remember we had a bonus episode that was like a TV series came out in Sweden called, how do you pronounce that? I think you had actually a FEMA scenario in the United States.
Oh, was it the pandemic one? The after Armageddon?
The EMP one, or the CMAE.
Well, there was American blackout, but that was just the grid.
Yeah, so it was basically a blacked out land.
Okay.
It was a reality show where they put 2 teams, one in like on the farm side in the house that had like a well and stuff like that, and one family team in a really modern house with all electricity, and they examined how it would go for each team. So it was actually state produced. So state has been a really active player in raising the preparedness in Sweden.
Okay, that to me, that experiment or that reality show, I mean, of course, you have to do, part of it is the sensational part of it, you know, like just, you know, like doomsday preppers and junk. But that would be pretty interesting. I mean, do you remember? I mean, what was the outcome of all of that?
Well, the outcome was that the team that was living in the modern house, several of them actually fled the production when they realized that they were also not allowed to use internet. I remember one girl from the capital who was pretty young. She decided first that, well, I'm just going to sit here. I'm not going to do anything. I'm going to preserve my resources. I'm not going to eat anything. I'm not going to do anything. And after 4 or 5 days or so, she just left. And in the end, they all moved into the farmhouse. So they had some fishing and stuff like that. But it was a really interesting experiment that also, even though they were actually strangers in the teams when they were assigned the house, only after 1-2 days, they were like considering the other team as strangers. So like, should we really give food to them? Should we really collaborate? Should we help them get water? And really interesting. So then we had a break for like, I think, 4 or 5 months. And then we recorded some episodes. And then I actually was hired by Volvo Trucks to head their security center. So I was the security manager for maybe 1.5 year. And then I really didn't have time. So, but then I came back to the Civil Defense Association, and then we like decided to, now we're going to give out like 2 episodes every week, and we're going to really go into depth of every aspect that we can think of. So we discussed like normal stuff like pantries and water filtration, but also the gray man and operation security and situational awareness and stuff like that. But we're not a doom and gloom podcast, so we don't ever talk about weapons. We don't ever talk about building a farm site, growing stuff. So it's mostly apartment citizens that we are our mainly target.
So what is the response then from the people that listen to the podcast? You know, I hear from people all the time from the podcast, and it is great. and they're from all different walks of life and all different ideas in preparedness, all from like, hey, I'm just preparing for a hurricane, all the way to like, I'm preparing for the, you know, like the polar shift and, you know, ice caps melting and on the whole deal. So what is it like, you know, when you hear from your audience?
Well, I have to say also, in the beginning, it was a pretty small community altogether in Sweden. The prepper community were like a subculture for real. Then 2018, the government sent a brochure to every household in Sweden called If the Crisis or War Comes. And that spooked a lot of people. And we had a lot of more questions about bomb shelters and stuff like that. But then it kind of, the interest kind of laid back to the normal level. And then with COVID, it was some interest. But then when the war began again in Ukraine, then we like 10-doubled our listeners. So it varies what people have questions. I mean, in the beginning, new listeners always have a lot about questions about war and bomb shelters and how to store water and food. And then when they hang around, we get to more like how to maintain your health, how to get economic budget that you can also get a buffer, how to like everyday preparedness. So we always try to steer them back to from the doom and gloom to everyday preparedness, like fire security, car security, protection from natural disasters, storms, winter, summer heat, which we actually haven't had for so long. I think maybe 2017 was the really hot summer and the first summer in Sweden in a long time where people actually died from the heat.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. And I love that you're doing that. I try to focus more on that as well. I mean, if you've listened to any of the episodes, you know that. I think there are so many other things that we can be prepared for versus, you know, the end of the world as we know it type stuff. We know at some point it'll happen, you know, at some point things, you know, will happen. But there's a lot of living to do between now and then. It's funny that you brought that book up or that little pamphlet, because I did look that up when I knew you were going to come on, and you could basically take that little booklet, and I think it's only like 17, 18 pages long, and you could do a podcast episode on every single, you know, one of these little topics here. I thought it was pretty cool. So when this went out, do you remember the reasons why? Is it just because things were heating up in Europe, or I can't remember why. I remember hearing about it. I don't remember the reason.
I also been thinking about that, why 2018 was like the, I know that they started their own podcast about preparedness already, I think maybe 2 or 3 years before that. And then they talked a lot about Sandy, 2012. And I think there has been some major catastrophes in the Swedish history that has made everybody more aware. The tsunami in Thailand was one of them. There was a lot of Swedes who died there.
Okay.
And the problem there was that most Swedes didn't know what a tsunami was. So when the water disappeared from the beach, everyone went down to the beach and started like playing with the fishes and stuff like that. And when the big wave came, a lot of people died, and Sweden really wasn't prepared for that kind of disaster. Then we had a big ferry from Estonia who sank. And again, the big feeling in Sweden was that the government wasn't ready. So I think they had a lot of bashing. Actually, a couple of ministers had been fired because of the lack of preparedness in the Swedish government. So there was thoughts about it, I think, in the Swedish government, that we have to raise the awareness that when shit happens, the first line will be the citizens, because we don't have any stored food anymore. We had that during the Cold War. Then we actually had like a lot of oil and food, and I remember soap and underwear and stuff like that in warehouses. But most of that was given to the Baltic states when they had their like post-Soviet area.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it was probably a plan for them to raise the general awareness among Swedes. Right, I think the big thing when the brochures were sent out was that it included war, and we hadn't spoken about war in a long, long, long time. And I mean, the government have good analysts; they are aware of things. And I think when the situation in Ukraine started 2012. Things started like going with different plans in Sweden, and probably already then the NATO plans was in progress, because that takes a lot of years to get membership.
That's just really interesting, and I appreciate the fact that there would be government officials that would say, "Hey, we need to help our citizens be prepared," you know, at least here in the United States, that just seems so rare. I mean, we have some politicians that are out there talking about common sense type things, but most of it is all about themselves and staying in power and all that kind of stuff. When you were talking about the Cold War and, you know, having supplies, my first real understanding, I mean, my dad would always talk about how Sweden was always neutral and all that. But my first real understanding of Sweden and how they prepared in the past was a young woman who was from Sweden, and she was working here downtown in Houston. And she started back on there's a website called Meetup, and you can meet up people for whatever kind of things. I mean, if you have small dogs, you could do a meetup on small dogs. If you want to have a meetup for people who like Star Wars, you can do Star, you know, whatever, right? So she did a meetup for people who wanted to be into preparedness and survival. And I went to that very first meeting. And this was before I started Prepper website, before I started the podcast, before any of that. I was barely brand new into it. And she had gotten up and she had talked about how she was from Sweden, and she, her family had always been, you know, have always prepared. But most people in Sweden now aren't really doing that. That like they have places where they would go to shelter in place, but now they just use it for storage and different things like that. And she said, you know, being here in the United States, I realized that if anything happened, I don't know anybody. I don't have a group. And so she was trying to kind of build a little bit of a group. I don't know. I only attended a few of those, so I don't really know how it all went down, and I never stayed in touch with her. But I thought that was really interesting that was the case. And so now you kind of see things coming full circle, where your parents or the grandparents, like, hey, back in the day we used to do this, and now, you know, this is the thing that we really need to be doing. Now, are people taking this serious, or is it like, okay, the politicians are saying this, and you know, we'll take care of it when we have to?
I think it goes in waves. Every time something happens, it gives a lot of media, and the media is actually, I don't know if they think it's a good thing or if they think it's good news, but every time we have like a winter storm or some kind of forest fire, wildfire, they do a lot of coverage on it. And we had a big fire 2018 as well, where a lot of people got evacuated. And then just now this winter, just a couple of months ago, we had a big winter storm in the south of Sweden where some cars got stranded. I think like 100 cars for like 15 hours. They have to be evacuated by the army. And then there was a lot of talk about how to prepare your car and what you should have at home. So I think it goes up and down. We have seen a lot of more applying for membership in the voluntary defense associations. We have 18 of them and about 350,000 members. So that is like, what, 3% of Swedish populations. And we also see that when there are disturbances, shelves go empty in the stores. So just as you've seen during COVID and stuff like that. So sometimes there's impossible to buy water cans. Sometimes you can't buy stoves. Sometimes all the pasta is gone. But then I think, as most people, give it 2-3 months, they kind of forget about it. Maybe they eat out their pantry and they're back to where they were. So I think it's really hard to like make a lasting impression. I think the war really made more preppers in Sweden, but we don't know if they will persist. We cooperate with a man at the university here in Gothenburg, and he called them crisis preppers. They prepare for the crisis, the specific crisis, and then they kind of forget about it. His next step he calls integrated preppers, when they have like made it their everyday life. And then there are the extreme preppers who go self-sufficient and stuff like that. So the crisis preppers are probably going up and down during seasons. I think during the summertime, Sweden is a pretty good place. Not much happens, less preppers. Then the winter comes and it can get pretty cold out here. So then more preppers emerge.
That's interesting. And I love those labels, right? The crisis preppers, the extreme, which what were the intermediate preppers? Is that what you...
The integrated preppers.
Integrated preppers. That's pretty interesting. And I think we wind up seeing that as well. So you've mentioned the Swedish Civil Defense Association several times already, and I read that on your website that you're involved with that. Can you tell us a little bit about your work there and what it involves?
Well, I worked from the bottom, you can say. I started at the local office in Gothenburg, and then it was a lot of I teached CPR and first aid. That was basically the things I did. And we had some projects in the suburbs. And that is also a funny thing about the differences between Sweden and the United States. In the suburbs in Sweden, the poor people live. So that is like where the gang criminality is and all the nasty stuff. And in the center of the town, that is where mostly basically the rich people. I mean, there are rich suburbs, but mostly the suburbs. When you say the suburbs in Sweden, you mean where all the immigrants live and where you shouldn't be after dark if you're a white person.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
So we had a lot of integration projects. So I was teaching that. And then we started the CERT, CERT, Civil Emergency Response Teams here in Sweden. And then I became a training there so basically an instructor at the basic course. So I did that for a couple of years, and now I'm a national educator in leadership. So I teach the team leaders as basic leadership skills from all parts of Sweden. So maybe 10 weekends over the year, we hold those kind of courses.
What is that? I'm sorry to interrupt you. What does that involve? Teaching the leadership is it leadership, like how to deal with a crisis? Is it more how to deal with people, like people skills?
We tend to basically make the leadership course about finding yourself, okay, your own stress levels and your own aspects, how you communicate with people. So, I mean, in a crisis, you will probably be one of the biggest problems and not the other ones, right? Especially if you're a leader, if you can't balance your communication and take care of yourself, eat and sleep properly, it's not going to be a good team. So we teach about some different aspects about that: communication, stress management. We use Stephen Covey a lot from Utah to apply that, what you can influence, what you cannot influence, how you put up goals for the team, how you like prepare for the future, how you have to describe what you want in detail so that others can understand you and not have to like guess a lot of what leader wants. We have a saying in the Swedish army to act in the commander's intention. And if you're going to do that without him present, you have to know what he wants. You cannot just guess all the time. So it's a lot of visualizing what you want, like this explaining the goals and the premises of the of the crisis management, so to say.
That's great, man. That's awesome. That's a whole nother episode in itself. I'd love to hear more about that. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you when you were talking about your work with the Civil Defense Association. Go ahead. Keep going. Sorry to interrupt you.
I mean, we have like different levels. Originally, the Civil Defense Association was about putting blindfolds. Maybe it's the wrong word, but like not showing any light from the buildings if there were any bomb planes coming from Germany. So it started there. Then during the Cold War, we actually was taking care of the bomb shelters. So we were teaching people about nuclear fallout and first aid and stuff like that. And then when the Everlasting Peace came in the 90s, our FEMA, which is called MSB, was thinking about how can we use all these instructors like in everyday life. And then they looked at the statistics, how do people actually die in Sweden? And they realized that most people die at a heart attack, in cancer, in car accidents, drowning. So when I became an instructor, that was usually what the courses was about. We had a course called Our Vulnerability, where we actually presented the statistics, like this is how you're going to die. So you know, so you can like prepare for those risks. And it's actually kind of great to see the differences, because when I became an instructor like almost 15 years ago, we really focused on the deaths from older people falling, and also in different areas of work where construction and stuff like that. And there's actually half the amount of people who dies from falling now than it did like 10 years ago. So it has given fruit also. So that's really great to see. Also, the people that die from a heart attack is much lower now. Like everybody knows CPR now in Sweden. They actually has it mandatory in schools. And also the defibrillators have been more common in society. So we see that we do a difference in everyday life and not just preparing for the war, because preparing for the war is so distant. It's so abstract. I'm in the Home Guard as well, and we have a constant problem recruiting members. Like people join the army. Oh, we're going to join the army. This is so cool. And then there, nothing happens the next 3-4 years, and they leave the army again. So it's a constant recruitment problem. And I think that is the key to keep it like live, to like focus on the things that happens now and here that you hear of every day. I mean, you know someone who had a heart attack, you know someone who had a car accident, you know someone who had a fire at their home, but you don't know a lot of people that been to war.
I love what you're saying. It makes complete sense to me, and I know it's going to make complete sense to a whole lot of other people that are listening. The fact is that even if there was a poop hit the fan situation, all the things that y'all are teaching right now, the everyday type stuff, is still going to be relevant then as well. You know, it's not like it's not something that is not going to be important. People are still going to, even though there's a war, people are still going to die of heart attacks. People are still going to fall down. People are still going to, you know, need to have CPR and all that kind of stuff. And so it's really great to hear that. You mentioned the Home Guard. Can you elaborate on what that is just a little bit?
Well, the Home Guard is like, I think it's like a less cool thing than what you have. we basically, we're light infantry. We don't have any helicopters or something like that. We only have normal cars and some heavier weapons like grenade launchers and stuff like that, machine guns. So it's about, I think right now we're like 23,000 soldiers in Sweden on a population of 11 million. And we are growing. And now I have to say, I think the Home Guard will be a better unit in the future, because now that we joined NATO, I left the recon squad because of my age, and I'm now responsible for the medical services in a company. And we have now been promised new tents, new cars, new uniforms, and new weapons, which will be a really big lift, actually, because we had the German one, the G3 from Heckler & Koch, made 1946. And now we're actually going to get the AR-15, so 2 kilos lighter, like 5 pounds lighter gun. That will be a big lift.
Well, but the go ahead.
The Home Guard is also employed during natural catastrophes, so they put out fires, they help with floodings, they help looking for people. So they, when the police have need more people looking for someone in the forest, they call the Home Guard. So they are part voluntary, part conscripted, so to say.
Kind of like our National Guard, I would think. And then we have different levels of that, you know, depending on the states and stuff like that. I had always heard, and I think it was my dad who would always talk about it, that everybody that would go through, and you had mentioned it, that it's not mandatory anymore, but everyone who went through military in Sweden got to keep their firearm. And so everybody had a firearm in Sweden. I mean, that's what you would always hear. That's what he would always say. But you said that so going through the military is not, that's not the that's not mandatory anymore.
Now, I think before the major wars started in Europe, I'm talking about Israel and Ukraine and Yugoslavia, which is now 7 different countries. I actually remember when I was a new prepper, I looked up Sweden regarding guns per inhabitants, and then we were top 5 in the world. So yes, there are a lot of guns in Sweden, mostly hunters, of course, but we also have like 400,000 registered handguns. So it's quite a big sport, and I think some people have handguns because they like the sport aspect of it, but yes, some people have handguns for self-protections. Even if you're not allowed to carry it outside your home or the shooting range, they're very strictly regulated. There are a lot of guns everywhere. And during the Cold War, everyone that had a scripture had their gun at home. But then we had some rampages. I think it was during the 90s, actually. Well, some shootings, killings, and then they more regulated it. So nowadays, all the weapons are at the regiments, and there is actually one squad per company that has their weapons at home, who are supposed to like liberate the weapons if necessary. But no military guns are in the society anymore. And I mean, the military service has really plummeted after the Cold War. I remember my father is born in the 40s. Then it was made mainly mandatory. I mean, every guy was doing military service. But when I did it at 1997, it was down to 8%. And then a couple of years later, it was 0. And now they're trying to raise it again to about 6%. So now you do 2 tests. First, you do an online test where you answer a lot of questions about your habits, your health, and stuff like that. And my daughter actually made the first test and made it to the second test, but they flunked 70% there already online. Then you go into a recruitment center, and then you do physics and an intelligence test and a telegraph test and a psychology, psychic evaluation, and then they cut another 70%. Wow. So basically from 100,000, they keep 7,000 to 8,000 now. So it's up to maybe 8% again. And that is a big difference if you see compared to Finland, where 75% of the males still do military service. So Finland is actually the third biggest army in NATO. Oh. And they only have like 5 million inhabitants.
That's interesting. Yeah, I guess, I mean, there's people probably who delve into all of that. I guess I try to stay up with the news that I hear in Europe, but I don't get that specific as far as what militaries, how many people are involved in each military. So jump into more of the preparedness aspect of it. I mean, I believe you're reading articles and you're watching videos and you've mentioned that you listen to this podcast as well. How is preparedness different? You've kind of talked a little bit about it, and maybe if you could go into more detail. If not, you know, that's fine too. But how is preparedness different or viewed differently in Sweden than it is in the United States? Is it just that it's more common sense, or is it the same? You know, what do you see?
I think modern preparedness in Sweden has gone from like an interest, common sense, to actually state mandatory. There is actually a decree that you have to be self-sufficient for at least 7 days. And the government has a vision that it will, if 3 months, we're supposed to like withstand any disaster that brings to Sweden, but also that after 7 days, there will be like food and water distribution centers. So, and not everyone is listening to that. And I also think that a big difference, I've been to New York and Washington and Philadelphia, and a majority of the Swedes are living in apartments. We're a really urban community. And I think that most people in the United States live in houses. Even if you live in a city, you have a house. That is not the case here in Sweden, because houses are really, really expensive. So preparedness for most Swedes are that you live in an apartment, maybe two to three bedrooms. And it's really hard to like balance the space where you can put things, especially water. I don't think anyone in Sweden, I mean, a really, really small percentage has the right amount of water, because it takes a lot of space and you don't have that space. So, I mean, water for a family for 7 days, that's a lot of water, and that's probably going to take a closet, which you need for clothes and other stuff. So I think most people are like, they try to get the easy way out. There are a lot of prep boxes. Actually, the state also recommends it. And there's been a lot of different aspects from it. There are some companies that actually directly sell prep boxes for a week for 2 to 4 family members. And it's been a big business now. Such a big business that actually the state, the FEMA, has gone out with a warning to say that not all of them are good people. You could probably go to the grocery store and buy those things yourself for half the price, but it's been a big commerce about it. So people buy the prep box, they put it in the closet, they forget all about it. So
That is the easy way. So when you say prep box, though, it's like, are you talking about just food storage and water, or is it just food storage, or is it like even supplies that a prepper would want?
Now, a normal prep box consists of foremost an emergency radio, because the state broadcast will go out through radio. Okay. Then it's usually some kind of gas kitchen, a smaller one that you use when you go camping and stuff like that. Then it's usually a foldable water can to collect water from some other sources. And there's usually a blanket that I've seen in most prep boxes and some matches. And that's basically it. It's not any food because that you have to provide yourself. So,
okay. All right. That's interesting. That's very interesting. And it's I guess it's cool that the government would come out and say, hey, you know, don't give in to the scare tactics. You know, we all kind of wind up dealing with that. So you've said you've seen them, you know, come in waves and stuff like that. Just recently, and you've already talked about it, Sweden joined NATO, which I think it was 200 years. Sweden has been neutral. I think that's what I was reading. Neutral, and then just recently they joined NATO. So talk to us a little bit about the overall feeling of that and what you're hearing. You know, maybe even I guess what you can, because you are involved in I guess, you know, government per se in leadership, what you can share, you know, and still be okay and things like that. But share with us just a little bit about how the overall public is taking all that.
Well, first to say is that the general public that isn't very aware has actually begun speaking and thinking about NATO now during this last process. But we joined the NATO military forces already in the 90s. When we thought in Yugoslavia, it was with NATO. We were in Afghanistan, we were in Iraq, we were in many parts of Africa, and I'll usually look up how many countries that we are fighting in at the regular basis. And usually the Swedish Army are in 7 different countries fighting with the NATO forces. So, I mean, we've been a part of NATO for a very long time, for at least 30 years. And I see it in the civil defense that we have joined NATO's regulations a long time ago. All our first aid are made in English and following the NATO, like the letters with the L, A, B, C, D, and E. And I mean, for us working with this, both the civil defense and the military defense, NATO isn't a new thing. We actually was forced to communicate in English during a couple of years also in the Home Guard. But it didn't go that well with the older people. It made a lot of delays. So nowadays you can like switch in which language you want. So basically what we did now, 2024, we signed on Article 5. But that was the last article. We already been working with all the other articles in the NATO. And as to the public, there, I mean, there's a lot of crazy people. I mean, Sweden is a socialist country. You have to like remember that we have a big welfare system. We have a state that regulates most of the things. And there are also a lot of lefties and the Green Party, which are some kind of crazy people. And the biggest concern now that I heard is that, oh no, I don't want my grandchildren to go to fight in Turkey against like the Kurds. And I like, well, why should your grandchildren go to Turkey to fight the Kurds? Because we're part of NATO. Yeah, but it's not a NATO war. It's a domestic war in Turkey. We shouldn't care about that. So that is one misconception. The other thing is that there's actually a big public movement now to force the government to say no to nuclear weapons. Like when we join NATO, America will give us nuclear weapons. And I like, no, that's like a big privilege to have nuclear weapons in a country. They don't want to give them out to every member who joins. And there are like a very few countries in the world that actually are allowed to have nuclear weapons. That is also, I think, totally crazy. So most people will never notice a difference now. Yes, our spendings in the military have increased. We now have to make 2% of the gross production for the country. But if you consider inflation, basically, that won't give any extra. That's just going to maintain it at the current level. I mean, we have an Air Force that is one of the Europe's strongest, and that costs a lot of money. An Air Force pilot, I think he probably may spend more money than my entire company does in a year. So, and we also have the submarines, are really good, but they also cost a lot of money. So,
that's very interesting. Very interesting. Man, we've been going for a while, and it's just good to talk to you. I want to ask you one final question. What's one question in preparedness that you wish people would ask you, but they never ask you? You know, it's like this is an important question, but nobody ever asked me about this. What is one of those questions that you have that you wish people would ask you?
I'm actually doing an experiment now, and I think that has been one part of our work now with home preparedness during the last year. Like, when do things actually get critical? Because I think people put a lot of stress into, oh no, I don't have any water, I don't have any food, oh, I don't know what to do. And they like make irrational actions, and that will get them into trouble, instead when they just could have like laid back and waited for better opportunities. So actually right now when we're talking, I'm doing a Katrina scenario where I listened to a lot of podcasts about Katrina, and I realized that it was like they had a lot of food, and then the flood came and they had to evacuate to somewhere, the Congress or the stadium. And when they get there, there was no water. And then it started to rain a bit, or they got water, but they got no food. So a week ago, I ate, and this is probably not a good thing, but I ate 10,000 calories in one day. Then I walked 100,000 steps. Then I was without water and food for 3 days. And I am without food for 7 days additionally. So now when we're speaking, I haven't eaten in 7.5 days.
Hey, I mean, hey, you're able to focus and you're able to talk,
yeah, but that is the thing. I mean, we don't need as much as we think. We don't need water every day. We don't need food every week. And there's, the body will compensate. So I think most of the situations, even in like car accidents and floodings, and also we have the most people that die during cold events here in Sweden is that they try to find a better place, and they do it with bad equipment and with bad decisions. And sometimes it's just better to wait it out, like to the first 72 hours, no matter what your situation is at home, wait 72 hours. Give the government some planning. If there are civil unrest and stuff like that outside, just lock your doors, shut down your windows, turn off the lights, wait it out 72 hours, and just read a book or something, talk to each other. And then after 72 hours, yes, then you have to find water. I've done 100 hours without food and water, and I could still walk 10 miles and do active stuff. So just relax, be prepared. But if you are not prepared, if shit happens when you're at a hotel or in your car, just wait it out. The body is way more prepared than you think, because when we were hunters and gatherers, we didn't have food every week.
Very good. Good advice to not panic. And I think a lot of people do. When you panic, you make bad decisions. So really great advice. Nicholas, how can people find you if they are now? When I go and look, I mean, a lot of it is all Swedish stuff, right? I was able to do Google Translate on your website, and I was able to read some of those things. Is there anything out there for in English that people can go to?
No, that was a decision we made in the beginning, because I was listening to your podcast, and I was listening to Dale and Lisa. They had the Survivalist Academy podcast. I think it isn't there anymore, And now you have like practical prepping and you have a lot of podcasts. And actually in Sweden, we also have a lot of podcasts. We are very similar to the United States in many aspects. So we didn't really see any point of making our material into English. So now it's only for Swedes, and then it's hemberedskap.se. And then you can find all of other resources. So we try to do some YouTube. We mainly do the podcast. We are going to be better at blogging. We're going to do a restart now after Easter. And every time we put out an episode, we're going to write an article about it. So you can like get the links and go into depth and stuff somewhere. But no, unfortunately, no content in English.
Well, I think I linked already in the previous episode, but I'm going to do it again. If there's anybody who wants to go and maybe you know the language and you can listen, or you can go over to the website and go check it out. Nicholas, thanks so much for hanging out with us on this episode. Very interesting. And I really do appreciate talking to you. Maybe we can do another one in the future and talk a little bit about the leadership aspect of it, because I think that's important. You know, if we ever find ourselves in a situation where we're going to have to gather people, we're going to have to help people come together, I think that would be really great advice.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was a great speaking with you, Todd, in person, not only listening and being interactive. So have a great weekend.
Thank you so much.
Well, Nicholas, once again, thank you so much for this great interview. I greatly appreciate it. It was a really nice long one with a lot of great information. So guys, I hope you enjoyed that one too. And I hope that you're able to apply some of the things that Nicholas and I were talking about. You know, Nicholas is one of those guys that you could probably just sit down and, you know, drink some coffee, maybe a beer, you know, maybe some iced tea if you're down from the South, like that real iced tea, you know what I'm talking about? And then, you know, you just talk a little bit about preparedness. And that's kind of what we do on our Tuesday night meetups when we do that through Zoom in the Ready Your Future exclusive email group. And so it's kind of what reminded me of that. You know, it's like, you know, we just kind of get together and a lot of us just kind of just sharing what we know about preparedness. So that's really cool. All right, guys, don't forget to go check out his links. And, you know, again, it's all in Swedish. So you're going to need to be, if you understand the language, more power to you, you're going to be able to do that. But if not, you could go over to his blog and use a translation tool or, you know, Google Translate or something like that. But I'm going to leave all that information in the description of the episode. You can go check that out. Well, guys, that's another episode of Ready Your Future for you. So glad that you have hung out with me on this one. Hey, if you want to hang out with a community of very knowledgeable preppers, safe from the algorithms of social media, come check out the Ready Your Future exclusive email group. This is an email group where you can ask questions, participate in discussions, attend our virtual online meetups that happen twice a month, and you don't have to deal with trolls. That's what's great. It's super affordable and well worth it. There is a link in the show notes or visit readyyourfuture.com. And with that, choose to live a more self-reliant life. Choose not to be so dependent on the government, grid, or the grind. Until next time, live with no regrets and stay prepped and aware. Peace.